Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin, in for David Ford. Today's show might just make you want to... We'll be talking to some of the leading artists in the field about the rigor, beauty, and creativity of the art form. First, dancer and teacher Catherine Cabine remembers her audition for one of the most competitive companies. Then it's the one, the only, Bill T. Jones. David Ford interviewed the world-renowned choreographer, dancer, director, and writer. Later, we'll talk to dancer and UNCG associate professor Dwayne Cyrus as he and his company, the Cyrus Art Production, gear up for Dance Gala Greensboro, an event celebrating men in dance. We've got Karoff dancing across the ivories on understanding classical music, and finally, Helen Cimino talks world tour with David Ford. All of this coming up after the news. There are lots of great must-see artistic traditions in the Triad. Eastern Music Festival in Greensboro, NC Shakes in High Point, and Rinalda House in Winston-Salem. You can add the seasonal dance productions by the UNCSA School of Dance to that mix as well. UNCSA School of Dance is led by 20-year ABT principal dancer Susan Jaffe. It's one of the best in the country, and their performances are full of compelling choreographies. One of those compelling performances was D-Man in the Water, by MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Bill T. Jones, performed this past winter. Few, if any, dancers can speak of D-Man in the Water's challenges and transformative powers better than our first guest today, hyphen artistic director Catherine Cabine. She's a former Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company performer, and when not leading her own company, she's a visiting lecturer at Middlebury College in Vermont and a teaching artist for Bill T. Jones. She brought her wealth of experience to UNCSA, coaching the young dancers there through the incredibly demanding D-Man choreography and helping navigate both high school and college students through the competitive world of dance. Catherine's experience extends back to her teenage years as a young dancer with Bill T. Jones' Arnie Zane Dance Company.
How much time were you given to prepare for the audition? Was it in real time?
Oh, yeah. It was in real time.
you're looking at the choreography and internalizing it and doing it in the moment?
Yeah, at that time, Bill had his whole company present at the audition. And it was great because then you had a number of teachers and they would sort of do the phrases with us. But there were 450 women at the audition then. So they were running it through. There was no time to waste.
Oh, my gosh.
The first thing that struck me was the complexity of the counting structure and this intellectual rigor. The second thing that struck me was that the nature of the movement itself was completely uncodified, and that was really exciting. Then actually having all of those dancers from Bill's company there, that was also really exciting because at that time he was working with a woman named Alex Beller who is incredibly voluptuous. She is an outstanding dancer and also with Bill made a huge contribution to breaking a lot of the body image ideas for women in the dance world. When I saw her and realized that she was a part of the company, I knew I absolutely wanted to join this company no matter what, because I'm 6 feet tall. I've always been told I'm, in quotes, too big and I take up too much space. And a lot of dancers go through this. They're too this, they're too that. You're too short, you're too tall, you're too skinny, you're too fat, you're too fast, you're too loud, whatever it is. And one of the greatest things about Bill's company is that Bill looks for people that are too whatever. And then he grabs that thing about you that makes you too much for any other environment you would walk into. And he nourishes it and brings it out and allows you to see that what makes you an individual is what gives you strength. And then also what gives individual strengths is what makes a community strong. Because we're not all in his company, you're not striving to be the same. You're striving to be different and work together. And that's a really great kind of community to be a part of.
I appreciate the company for what you all offer in terms of the spectrum of just visually and of course, the dedication to pull this off. And looking at the 1999 video of yourself performing in D-Man, but I'm just curious, just off the top, what comes to mind?
Well, the aesthetic of effort is something that both actually Martha Graham and Bill T. Jones embrace. So hopefully we don't make it look too easy. And that's actually something I have to really work with the students on a lot, because they're coached in classical training, where making it look easy is always the goal. And we're trying in Demon in the Waters to keep it always so that they are actually at their physical edge. And the argument in a lot of Bill's work is that human beings at their physical edge has its own inherent beauty. And there are some really amazing moments when you're performing D-Man, because it is so difficult. It's extremely cardiovascularly difficult. It's like a 15-minute sprint, the first section of that piece, that you're constantly on your own physical edge, and then other people are counting on you to catch them. And when I was 19 and joined the company, I think like many people who study dance, I had an incredible love for the arts, which I still do, but it's a tough world, and it's often very cruel. And I think a lot of young women, especially, who start training very young and push themselves very hard in dance, there's often a lot of issues in terms of self-esteem. And what D-Man gave me was the opportunity to realize that other people needed me. And it didn't actually matter whether I liked myself or not. I had to be there for other people. And in order to support others, I sort of started to realize that I was worth taking good care of because I was a part of a community that needed me. And there's a really beautiful interplay, I think, between the development of oneself and the development of relationships that happens in D-Man. And I hope when I reconstruct the piece that the students will find that. You know, they're in, particularly here at UNCSA, it's a really excellent but competitive conservatory. And D-Man should be a window out of the competition into a collaboration and into a community where the individuals are not important because of how high they can jump. They're important because they're going to be there to catch their friends. And there's something really beautiful that is inherent in the piece. And I love that that gets taught through this choreography.
To get at those broader issues of self-esteem and how it played out in your own life, is there a way that you can nurture that? I mean, are you aware of hoping to impart that sort of message to the dancers?
Definitely. I take teaching very seriously. I do tell the students a lot of stories, both about my own life and also sort of the oral history that I learned from talking to original cast members that created D-Man in the 80s. And I share a lot of stories, and I do like to teach through parables, certainly. But the great thing about D-Man is that a lot of these lessons and ideas are in the choreography itself. That's what makes it brilliant. No one's acting trust in this piece. No one's acting support. You have to be there, or your friend will break their ankle. So it's a very real relationship to responsibility that the choreography implies. D-Man is still in the company's repertory, so the piece is still changing. Whenever he reconstructs it, he changes things a little. So my job as a repeteur is to keep up with those changes, but also to let the students know that the work is alive through them. In the reconstruction process, we never look at a video, because I don't want these students to think that they should be trying to dance like somebody else. And I'm really adamant that I'm going to give them the tasks that make up the movement, but that they need to find their own way through it, because they don't want to dance it like, you know, Larry Goldhuber did. They want to dance it in their own best way.
How have they responded to that? Is that a big challenge in itself to say it's you?
Yes, especially for highly trained dancers. It seems that the more technical training dancers have, the less ability they have to bring themselves to a task. And that is a really interesting conundrum that we find ourselves in as dance teachers. Because within Bill's work, I mean, you need to land in a fifth position, change directions. It's very difficult choreography. So you need that technical foundation, and you need a teacher who's just been drilling and drilling and drilling you. I mean, dance technique is something where there's nothing to it but to do it. You know, there's no app. You can't download it. You can't read about it and then have it suddenly be in you. You have to practice. And so the challenge for contemporary dancers, and it's a serious challenge, is to figure out how to follow through on that technical rigor and maintain and develop a sense of self that will change through time. And then I think that my generation of dance teachers is really chewing on that question, because it's a really juicy question. How do you instill enough discipline in a dancer that they will be able to do what choreographers are asking for these days, which is extreme, but also that you're working on the development of a whole person who will be a better dancer if they know who they are and how they feel about the world that they live in, but also who will be a better human being, whatever role dance plays in their life as they grow.
Yeah. This juxtaposition of vulnerability and desperation against Mendelssohn's Octet in E-flat major. Why did he choose this piece of music here? And has he ever talked to you about that? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Bill was really clear that the music was very much at the heart of the piece when they created it. You know, it's important to remember that though now when we hear Mendelssohn, we think, classical. Mendelssohn wrote that piece when he was 18. And it was a complete break from what music was doing at that time. So he was a total punk rock star in the music world at the time that that piece was written. And so Bill took that energy from it and wanted to create something that was very much a form of music visualization. Music visualization is a dance term where the dance very much follows the rhythms and lines of the music. Bill wanted to take the structures and the different lines in the music, but also keep alive that sense of teen angst and rebellion that Mendelssohn had when he wrote the piece. And I think that the aggression and vigor of the movement helps us to hear that music differently, so that we don't necessarily think about white-haired people in suits playing it on beautiful wooden instruments. And instead, we think about the youth and vigor that causes someone to write something with so much energy in it. The music itself just gets you moving, you know?
Yeah. I think it came out right around the time he had taken a pretty massive road trip to Europe, and out of that comes Fingal's Cave and the Scotch Symphony and a whole bunch of works. He was just a young guy out there checking out the world.
Yeah, yeah. And that sense of adventure and spiritedness, we can still hear. It's a really interesting thing about choosing historic pieces of music, or even for the sake of comparison, historic bits of movement vocabulary, and then juxtaposing them with kinesthetic images that are more contemporary. Because I really do think it helps us to become more sophisticated in how we hear and how we see when we look at the past and the present not as separate, but actually as a continuum and as something where all of those aesthetic conversations and all of those technical conversations are feeding one another to create the present moment in art that will take us into the future, hopefully.
Teaching artist for Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company, Catherine Cabine. She's also the artistic director for Hyphen, formerly Catherine Cabine and Company, visiting lecturer at Middlebury College in Vermont, and thankfully for UNCSA dance students, teaching artist for Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company. Since 2006, she's set Bill T.'s MacArthur Genius Grant-winning work, D-Man in the Waters, on student dance companies across the country. UNCSA School of Dance performed the work this past winter as part of UNCSA's Winter Dance 2013. Internationally renowned choreographer, dancer, theater director, and writer, Bill T. Jones appears in practically every dance history book that's been printed in the last 20 years. He's received major honors from the MacArthur Genius Award to Kennedy Center honors, and his ventures into Broadway resulted in 2 Tony Awards for Best Choreography. Last fall, the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company was in residence at Salem College, working with Salem dance students on the campus in Winston-Salem. It was part of the new June Porter Johnson series for the visual and performing arts. David Ford spoke to Bill T. Jones by cell phone from Mr. Jones' hotel in Paris.
So go back to the 2 young guys who innocently are dancing together in Germany, and suddenly they're being called black and white. And they had, through their hippie countercultural naivete, they thought that they were neutral, what they were doing. But the world did not see them as neutral. Fast forward another 10, 15 years, Arnie Zane has died, and now I am in the crossfire of a very heated social-political discussion around what is the norm, what are the values of the era, and all these outside voices, these people who are shouting for their identity, were they in fact self-indulgent victims holding the good-hearted liberals with guilt? Or were they, in fact, the clarion voices of the future? I think they were the clarion voices of the future. I had decided that I didn't have to be political. I just had to do the work I did, and it would be, I said that my politics are like my face. I cannot get away from my attitudes and my feelings, not to mention my race and so on. So I just thought I would make the most beautiful works I could. We made works completely to chamber music. We did all those things. Then I was asked to do a commission for the Ravinia Festival on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln. I could do anything I wanted. So I tried my hand at making a big public spectacle, complete with the story of Honest Abe. But it would be also peppered with a kind of robust, physicalized, rolling, tumbling dancing that Arnie Zane and I used to do, but now performed by an entirely new group of people, some of them the age old enough to be my children, and with much more virtuosic technique than he and I had. There was also going to be a live band. There was. We had a Clarissa Cincino. He's a fantastic classically trained singer who is a jazz singer and an opera singer. The music is done by a kind of East Village rock and roll kind of guys, Chris Lancaster. We were really trying to mix it up in terms of the different cultural reference points and in terms of historical and ethnic racial reference points, saying that this was, in fact, the legacy of Abraham Lincoln's vision for America.
I really enjoyed the PBS special covering A Good Man, the creative process and how the real-time nature of the work's evolution, how it morphed from what seemed like toward the end there, a day-to-day, one big one came after you're hearing the sound of a train. Would you tell me about at that point, are you feeling fear? Are you channeling anxiety? What's going through your mind when you suddenly are pivoting at that level, close to a deadline of that, you know, significance?
Well, yes, that's to the credit of the filmmakers. Now, you realize a documentary is only a portrait of subject, not necessarily the subject, but... So, yeah, they made it very dramatic. It was dramatic. Yeah, there was concern about what, were we ready? I think when we even premiered it, we said we didn't think we were ready, but we were going to do our best, and we did. And when the work was premiered at Ravinio, we went on and continued working on it for easily another half year of touring, which is what is accepted. But, you know, that thing with the train was actually it's actually one of the glorious, mysterious parts of creation. Just when you don't know what is missing, suddenly something comes into your subconscious or your conscious mind that was like standing there the whole time and slaps you in the face. That was a wonderful, I think it was a joy, as you could probably see. I was very happy when I heard it. Something, a connection was made. I say this to young dancers, and I will say it in the lecture, is that a lot of art making is about responding. A lot of art making is about staying alert, open, listening. This is invaluable. You cannot, some artists do, I don't, down and write out everything that's going to happen and then go do it. I think you propose something, and then there is something else that gets counter-proposed, and then an accident happens that is better than anything you thought of. But are you really fleet enough? You know, I'm an old athlete, so I understand what it means to be back on your heels or forward on your toes. You've got to be forward on your toes so you can go in any direction. That's what was happening in the Good Man documentary, watching me deal with my emotions, but also and the personalities of the people around me and the circumstances of the engagement, but just trying to bring the thing in, bring it in whatever form it chooses to be in. That's all we can do. That's why I say it's a spiritual activity. It's not science. It's not politics. It's not mathematics. It's something more mysterious than that. It's called art making.
Oh, I had the privilege of speaking with Wayne Shorter 2 weeks ago, and he was coming up on his 80th birthday talking about that exploration and diving in and taking chances and being vulnerable and finding things within that I think speaks to that to some degree.
Well, that's why I think that artists should be trusted with the education of the young. That's why I think artists should be part of social planning, and we should be part of the discourse. I had said at the beginning of Mr. Obama's term, I was agreeing with Quincy Jones, who was sending out a request that there be a cabinet-level position for the arts. It has never, well, we had so many problems with the economy and so on, but that didn't get off the ground. But I hope that someday someone will take that seriously, that we need a secretary of culture, as the French have, at the highest levels of government.
I couldn't agree with you more on that score. You're in every dance history book there is. Bill, you've received just about every major arts award and honor there is, which, you know, most folks would say is a great honor and privilege and a good thing. But I was wondering, personally, if you feel a weight that can sometimes come with that sort of recognition. I mean, or is there a downside? Mm-hmm. How do you juggle that?
Well, that's a very intelligent way of putting it. Well, it's a weight if you let it be. I do sometimes, I tell people, I say it's all smoke and mirrors. That's true to a point. When you're an irreplaceable treasure or whatever, what the devil does that mean? Irreplaceable treasure. Everything can be replaced. I think I've done some good work. I think I've proposed some interesting questions that other people have picked up and continue to answer. And maybe you can ask nothing more than that, particularly in a time-based art form like my own. I think that would be the best answer I could give is that right now I'm in a position where I'm working on a lot of fronts. I'm executive director of the New York Live Arts. I am still director and chief choreographer of Bilty Jones and Zane Dance Company. And I direct Broadway musicals. But the question is, at any one time, particularly with the dancers, is what's worth doing? What is the next step? What is really worth doing? And with age, when you've done so much and you've been acknowledged and misunderstood, the heart becomes a little like leathery. You know, when you're young, it's like a balloon. It swells and shrinks and swells and shrinks. And as you get older, it becomes leathery. And if you let it, it will calcify. I am trying my darndest not to let that happen. And that's about the quality of the questions. That's about keeping the people around me youthful and upbeat. And that's about trying to be honest, like trying to talk to you right now. And really say something that I'm not quite sure what I'm saying, but I'm trying to be sincere. I'm trying to be authentic. That's how I do it. And like I say, I wake up every day with questions about, will I make it that day? I do, and I expect to continue.
World-renowned dancer-choreographer Bill T. Jones spoke with David Ford by cell phone from his hotel in Paris. The Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company was in residence at Salem College last fall, working with Salem dance students on the campus in Winston-Salem. It was part of the June Porter Johnson Series for the Visual and Performing Arts. That week, there was a screening of the PBS American Masters documentary, A Good Man, which chronicles Jones' intense creative journey as he takes on the most challenging work of his career. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray. You can watch the documentary online. Find the link at our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. D-Man in the Waters by Bill T. Jones incorporates the music of Felix Mendelssohn. And later this hour, Peter Karoff is back at the keyboard to explore the work of this composer. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin, in for David Ford. University of North Carolina, Greensboro, School of Music, Theater, and Dance, Associate Professor Dwayne Cyrus is a gifted dancer choreographer, eloquent champion of the arts, and a very, very busy man. In addition to his work at UNCG, Dwayne is the artistic director of Cyrus Art Production and Vital Grace Project. He's continually bringing high-quality, diverse, and exciting performances to North Carolina audiences. Coming up on September 20th, Cyrus Art Production presents Dance Gala Greensboro, the Vital Grace Project. The theme for the evening is Men in Dance, and the evening will feature performances of grace and athleticism. The program begins at 7, and tickets are $15. David Ford spoke with Dwayne.
I did get a chance to check out Gotham Online. Thanks for sending the links, because I just love to have a chance to kind of, you know, I get really up close to the screen and pretend like I'm in the audience. Or I guess
right, turn out the lights.
Exactly. Okay, cool. Exactly. With Gotham, I love the combination of just the physicality of the choreography of the movements with the very graceful hand gestures and upper body movements. So talk about your choreography, I guess, philosophy going into that.
Well, I'm influenced from a lot of different genres of dance. You know, there's modern dance in my background. There's also ballet and jazz. Being an African-American growing up in the Bronx, it was really important for me to sort of see differences and understand differences. So my whole career as a performer has been about integrating different styles and speaking in different languages, really. So Gotham, what you're seeing in it is modern dance, but the gracefulness of, like, sort of balletic line or balletic grace in it, but also the weight of modern, and that theatricality is very important as well. So it's got a meaning. The dance has a meaning. When I choreograph, I definitely seek to have my performers involved theatrically.
The music struck me as well. It was beautiful, kind of a classical and almost in a minimalist sort of way. Talk about the composers for that work, because that was an interesting juxtaposition, the very contemporary movement of some of the dance lines paired with some of this more almost neoclassical sound.
Yes, it's the Balinescu Quartet, and the music is called The Empty Space Dance, and just the title alone, like, got me. When I saw that title, I thought, okay, well, that's already telling me I need to make a dance about it. It's kind of haunting, the music, but it also carries the dance along without intruding on it.
Gotcha.
And I thought that was important.
I think of in a jazz setting, the greatest drummers just kind of stay out of the way, but they augment at the same time.
That's right, yeah.
Hey, what was your scene growing up in the Bronx as a dancer? Were you at an arts-based school?
Actually, I went to the Bronx High School of Science, and my mother really is one of my first influences in terms of theater. She took me to see Broadway shows like The Wiz on Broadway, which was actually the first musical I ever saw, and that's how I fell in love with theater and performance.
Boy, that production influenced so many young actors and dancers and performers.
Most definitely. And so I sort of stuck with that, and then there was a musical called Dreamgirls. And I remember by this point I was in high school, and I remember seeing the poster on the subway in New York. And it was these three legs of black women. And I was like, whatever that is, I got to go see it. And I saved up my money. I was delivering newspapers at the time. I saved up my money, and I bought a ticket by myself because none of my other friends were interested in spending $40 for a ticket. And I think you can date my age by seeing that a ticket for a Broadway show was $40 then. And I saw Dreamgirls on Broadway with the original cast that included Jennifer Holliday. And that kind of really sealed it for me in terms of theater. I sought out classes. I just looked in newspapers like The Village Voice, and I found places to take class. That's really how I began my dance training. And I found a wonderful mentor. His name is Alfred Gallman. And he encouraged me to go to the Juilliard School where I got my undergraduate degree. And he also helped me meet people like Alvin Ailey, where I wound up dancing in Alvin's company as a professional.
Oh, how about that? That's right. I forgot about that. And there'll be an Alvin Ailey component to one of the upcoming concerts, too, when your stars...
That's correct. Karine Plantidy and I were colleagues in the Ailey Company. We danced together. And she went on to dance on Broadway in two of Twyla Tharp's shows, Moving Out and Come Fly Away. And she was nominated for a Tony for Come Fly Away.
Speaks to the quality of the dance that you provide and your colleagues coming to perform in the upcoming performance with stars. Before we get into that performance, I want to talk a little bit about Pas de Vie underscore.
Yes.
We were talking about the importance of music in your initial choreography, and we were talking about Gotham. But this score is kind of in reverse. I'm hearing the music, some more electronic, urban-sounding music paired with more classical ballet, at least what I would consider
right.
Classical ballet movements.
That's an interesting note. The classic sound of Gotham's music with more contemporary modern dance, and then with Pas de Vie, you have more contemporary music with balletic dancing. I think that what that speaks to, you know, and I would imagine it's intrinsic for me because I didn't make that connection. But when you say it, I see it, of course. But that type of juxtaposition is definitely an Africanist theme.
How so?
So the ability, if you think about, let's look at African dance, there's asymmetry in it. There's syncopation. You know, there are multiple rhythms in African dance. So I've studied African dance. I'm not an African dancer, but I carry that history still in my body and in how I practice as a contemporary artist. So that juxtaposition just makes sense to me.
At the outset of the clip that I saw, there was some real theatrical interaction between the male and female dancer. Is there a storyline through Pas de Vie, or is that just coincidental?
It's a light storyline. They're having a conflict. And when I created that work, I had in mind a classical pas de deux. So there's normally a structure to a classical pas de deux. It starts with an adagio, and then you'll have a male variation, a female variation, and then a coda. So loosely that follows it. And I just sort of felt like, okay, well, how would this couple look sort of in a more contemporary setting, influenced by Richard Bennett and Angus's music?
Dancer, choreographer, and UNCG School of Music, Theater, and Dance Associate Professor Wayne Cyrus. Coming up on September 20th at the Acock Auditorium in Greensboro, Cyrus Art Production presents Dance Gala Greensboro, The Vital Grace Project. The evening will celebrate men in dance and feature performances by special guest performers such as Lloyd Knight of the Martha Graham Dance Company, Ben Engel from the North Carolina Dance Theater 2, as well as ballet prodigy Aaron Bell. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin, and we're going to take another short break. When we come back, it's Care Off at the Keyboard, and then we continue to dance through the end of the hour with Helen Simoneau, who recently returned from a world tour. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin, in for David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Care Off at the Keyboard.
There's the beginning of a beautiful piece by Felix Mendelssohn. Dates from about 1830 or so, and it has a kind of a funny title, actually. It's called Song Without Words. Song Without Words, what does that mean? Well, in German, Lieder ohne Worte gives a little bit more of an insight into what Mendelssohn is after. You see, what he's done is he's written a piece for the piano alone, and yet he's conceived of it as if it were a piece for singer and piano, a song without words. Now, in Mendelssohn's day, and for many decades after, many composers, Brahms and Schumann and Schubert, and Mendelssohn himself wrote dozens and dozens and hundreds of these so-called Lieder, these songs, in which a singer sings a beautiful poem with lovely piano accompaniment. And yet here is a piece by Mendelssohn that's conceived of as if it were a song with a singer, and yet there's no words. So it's a rather evocative title. He invites us to imagine what the words would be had there been words. What's the poem? What's being expressed here? And so, as I say, it's structured like a song, so you have a little bit of an intro for the singer. And then your singer comes in with the beautiful melody in the right hand. Mendelssohn wrote dozens of these so-called songs without words over the course of his life. Most of them don't have any title beyond that, simply a piece, and you imagine what the poem is. Some of the songs without words, he gives us a little evocative title to help us and to kind of spur our imagination. For example, this piece has a beautiful rocking left-hand somber accompaniment here. And then the singer, as it were, comes in the right hand. And Mendelssohn helps us out a little bit by giving this a title that sort of focuses our attention. He calls this the Venetian Gondola Song. All of a sudden now, we're in Venice. And that rocking left hand isn't just simply a beautiful accompaniment, but it's the rocking of this boat. You'll notice that Mendelssohn puts those two notes in unusual places, not where you expect them, on beats 3 and 2. And so I've been in a gondola, and I know they're pretty unstable craft. So now the gondolier isn't just rowing, but he starts to sing. Unfortunately, most of the Venetian gondoliers I've heard sing don't sound that good. Now, there's a middle section in this piece in which there's a bit of a duet, not just one melody, but now two. Atmospheric. So you see how this works. It's this music being so evocative. Poems suggest imagery, but then here's music that suggests a poem. So it's almost taking the poetic suggestive qualities in a poem and taking it a step further so that the music suggests an imaginary poem. And as we listen, we can imagine what the words might have been had there been words. Very, very beautiful. These songs without words, Felix Mendelssohn.
Wake Forest University professor of music and Steinway artist Peter Karoff at the keyboard. Peter's covered everything from Bach to Brahms and beyond on this show, and you can find past episodes of Karoff at the keyboard on our website, wfdd.org. Dancer Helen Simoneau was born and raised in a small village of 1,000 people in Quebec, and somehow made her way to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, via the UNC School of the Arts as a high school student. What she lacked in formal training up to that point, she more than made up for in hard work and dedication to her art while in school. That effort, along with the mentorship she received at UNCSA throughout high school and college, has come to fruition in her award-winning solo dance work and critically acclaimed company, Helen Simoneau Dance. The Winston-Salem and New York-based group performs regularly at Hanesbrands Theater, and in May, Helen and her work began a month-long tour to Canada, Tokyo, and Korea, with residencies and performances scheduled in each location. On the tour, she presented her new work, Flight Distance 3, Chain Suite, as part of the International Dance X Tour, alongside works by her colleagues in Japan and South Korea. Helen's Flight Distance 3 is a duet that she performs with UNCSA alumna Kristen Taylor.
What was your big takeaway from your experience at UNCSA in the dance program?
That hard work really pays off, and that sounds maybe cliche, but it was definitely the truth for me because I came to the program, they really took a chance on me. I did not know my right from my left. I had very little dance experience. I just really loved it. I knew that I loved it, but I didn't have a lot of the training that my other classmates had. And so I was starting really from scratch, and it was clumsy at times. But I had a faculty that believed in me, and they always kept giving me information and helping me and rooting for me. And I felt like I really thrived in that environment. But it really hinged on the fact that I was very much ready to do the work, and I was willing to put those hours in and do the extra work outside of class to make it happen. And I worked really hard the whole time.
It seems like that sort of experience would be invaluable in terms of teaching.
Yeah, exactly. It also really made me realize when I started teaching that it doesn't always matter where the student is right at the beginning. It's the potential, and to really focus on the potential of the student and not already determine how far they can go based on where they are.
Yeah, and that's something that some teachers have a very difficult time giving off, that freedom. You can believe it intellectually, but if internally you don't believe it, you know, like you're going to pick the stars, the prodigies, and they're going to make it, the others aren't. It can be devastating for a young student.
Yeah.
And they
can feel it.
Yeah. From UNCSA, we can go all over the world with Helen Simoneau. Austria, Brazil, Canada, France, Greece, your work's been performed all over the world. Can you generalize in terms of how your work is received or the feedback you get from one part of the world to the next, or is it just a grab bag wherever you go?
I definitely feel like there's a difference in the audience reaction, what you can feel from the audience in different cities and different countries.
Uh-huh.
And I think it also depends on like what work that I perform, because I have some things that are quieter and some things that are more physical. But there is one solo work that I've performed in a lot of different cities, and that's been interesting in seeing the reaction of, it's a very quiet solo and requires concentration for the audience. And I've noticed that, like, when I performed it in Germany, it was like you could hear a pin drop. Like, there was just, like, so much attention. And then even at the end, it's like they didn't want to clap until they knew for sure that it was over. And so there was a bit of a pause. Yeah. They were just so respectful. And then when they did start clapping, it was like, I mean, I went to the wings and I came back out like 3 or 4 times because they just kept going. And it was just like such a euphoric feeling.
Interesting.
But then in other places, it's funny and it's just a different experience. Like in Greece, when I performed there, people were, I think they received it well, but they were very, I guess they expressed it well during the performance, what they were they were talking throughout.
Yelled it out.
I mean, they were like, I don't know if they were saying words, but they were making sounds and like, like things like,
Is that disarming on stage when you're hearing that?
I wasn't ready for it, but yeah. I quickly figured out that that was the deal. So I just kind of, you know, went with it. But it was kind of nice because it was just a different way of viewing work. And I felt from the sounds that they were making that they were actually engaged, so.
Yeah, well, that's the bottom line. Flight Distance 3 Chain Suite. Choreographing 13 minutes of movement strikes me as being just insanely difficult. I have no point of entree into that world. Talk me through the beginnings of this work and your creative process.
Well, the process for this work was in collaboration with the composer. So I worked with Jonathan Melville Pratt, who I know from college. He does a lot of work for different choreographers, mainly in New York. This was the first time actually I worked with him. And what we did is that I started on my end and he started on his end. We talked a little bit about the mood or the type of sound that, you know, I was interested in. But then from there, we both created and then came together at one, like at a midpoint, basically. And, you know, I was inspired by what he did and set some of the structures of the choreography based on his decision making. And then I also asked him, you know, could you, I really love this part, but I want to do it for the solo, which happens earlier in the piece. Could you move that? Would that, you know, would that be okay if we did this? And so he shifted things around based on some things that I needed for the piece, some structure mainly for the piece.
Had he just given you some thematic elements or an entire block of 13 minutes of sound? What were you given in terms of the audio initially?
At first, it was like a 5 minutes of trying different ideas. So it wasn't like a piece, a 5 minute piece. It was 5 minutes of like a reduced version of what he was going to maybe do for the entire work. So just to see what sounds I was attracted to. And then also of what sounds I really hated. So that he was like, just tell me what you don't like and I'll take it out. Sometimes we don't know what we want until we, you know what we don't want.
Does that go both ways? Does he ever say, you know, that gesture just doesn't strike you with this piece of, or this sound or that?
No, it doesn't go both ways.
That's why it's the Helen Cimino dance.
No, because I commissioned him, so I get to, you know, I get to do all the movement and he helps me. He's there to support.
Where's the joy in that process as it's been described so far for you? What part of that collaboration do you enjoy the most?
For me, it gets really exciting when things start to come together. So when I basically have a first draft, because a lot of times I'll work in, like, I'll make a little section here and a little section here. And sometimes, you know, I don't really know what the order of those sections is going to be and how one informs the other. So the first time that I string it together is, I think, where it gets really exciting for me, because then it really feels like something, it's really tangible, all the work, all the labor is right in front of me. And then I can actually start what I feel is like the art making at that point is really making those directorial decisions about what goes where and how the mood shifts from one thing to another.
Transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a lot of editing that goes on from that point, or are all the elements there and it's just a matter of plugging them in where they belong, or do you wind up cutting a lot from that point for once you've got it all out on the table?
I think for this piece, I didn't end up cutting a lot. For this piece, I had a pretty clear idea. I mean, I was also only dealing with two bodies. One of them is my own. And so that makes it a lot quicker, a lot more efficient as far as like having extra material. There wasn't a lot that we didn't use for this piece. However, when I do other works, especially larger groups, we make a lot of material. And then I go in and select and pull. And there's a lot of things that just don't end up making it into the final version.
Now, you and Kristen have danced together many times before, but this, are you having to then cater some of the movement to her strengths when you're going about the choreography initially?
I definitely consider what I know she does well in my movement choices. And also, there are also moments where, you know, I've given her a task and she generates movement. So specifically for her solo in this duet, I gave each of us a task and then we separately worked on it and then directed her from the outside of it. But she essentially generated the material for that solo work. That's within the piece. And then that, of course, you know, what she does well just comes out. But then for the rest of the piece, I always had her in mind when I was making the material. But with Kristen, you don't really have to, like, work to her strengths because everything she does just looks amazing. She is just really a great mover, and she can do like very trained, very technical things, and then she can also do a lot of like very physical floor work, and she also never gets tired. So it's a lot harder for me to not be in the work, but it's necessary for me to feel like I understand the work from the audience's perspective. So in the larger group works that I make, and by say large, I mean like for me, it's like five, six people. I very much like to be on the outside and I don't like to put myself in it because I don't have a good sense of what's happening. But once we get to the performance and I'm in the audience and there's nothing I can do at that point. And also as far as technical things can happen, you know, there can be mistakes with the lighting or with the sound, and there's really nothing I can do at that point. So it's a very kind of uncomfortable place to be until the piece is over.
getting that objectivity then from the audience and looking at your work as a choreographer, being in the audience, then how often do you have to revisit? Oh, you know, that gesture didn't really work from this perspective. Mm-hmm. And is that pretty common?
That's a really good question, yeah. I think it's never finished. I think at a certain point, I will maybe not be so, you know, after work has been performed a lot of times, I may not be so interested in the work as much anymore. Like, I'm ready to move on to something new. So I will stop. Like, I will stop working on it. But essentially, every performance that we have, I always want to go back in and tweak this or change that. And ultimately, every time I watch it, there's always going to be some things that, you know, I want to adjust. And sometimes having space between, you know, if I haven't seen the work in a while, yeah, and we come back to it, then I'm in a different place, you know, in my career. I feel I have different ideas. And so it changes the work. So I think that it gets to a certain point where the work is never finished. But I sometimes am finished with the work.
Helen Cimino, dance founder, dancer, choreographer, and educator, Helen Cimino. She recently completed a tour along with dancer Kristen Taylor, which brought Helen's new work, Flight Distance 3, Chain Suite, to audiences in Canada, Tokyo, and Korea during a month-long tour with residencies and performances scheduled at each location. It was part of the Dance X tour presented by Montreal-based venue Tangent. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org. Click on Triad Arts Weekend. That's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our intern is Kathleen Coker. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, links to and photos of all of our guests at WFDD.org. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm Bethany Chafin, in for David Ford, and thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.
Lose yourself to dance.